there's a natural fear for many people that when you start seeing the same scores over and over again, you ask, is this my plateau? Is this as good as it's going to get for me?
Hello and welcome to episode 453 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson, co-founder of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. With me is Eric Johansson, podcast producer, teacher, tutor. What else, Eric?
occasionally ask button respondent, but not too often these days. Yeah. Teaching, producing the podcast. That's most of what I do.
Okay. So if someone sends in an ask button question and they get a response from you, they were lucky.
It was, yeah, one of very few days out of the year when usually there was like Abigail was frantically on Slack saying, hey, we have too many questions. Can anybody jump on to help out here? So I was like, okay. Yeah.
And you
will answer the call.
That's nice of you, Eric. And I noticed that you do also step up and take classes a lot of times when people need help getting subs.
Yeah. It turns out when your teachers are largely law students and people who are on their way to law school, they got to ask out a lot of the time. They have busy schedules. So yeah, happy to pick up all those substitute teaching shifts. And teaching those classes is the highlight of my week, honestly. I always come out of those classes in a good mood, it seems like, because it's just fun to teach the LSAT and talk to people about this stuff.
It is fun to teach the LSAT and talk to people about this stuff. It's also just so amazing how supportive everybody is, right? Like the class is ending and everybody's like, thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, I never did that to my teachers, but I also wasn't like, I was sort of halfway there. By obligation, right? School was like half obligation, half like choice. I don't know.
You weren't the like teacher's pet sitting in the front row. Like, oh, teacher, I know the answer.
No, that wasn't you. No, I definitely needed to like buckle down to try to get myself to stay focused on school. If you want to be LSAT famous, you can share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. We have the June test coming up in about a month. That's on June 7th. The registration deadline has already passed. So if you're not signed up for June, you're not taking it. That is the last test with Logic Games. And then we will officially say goodbye to them. Starting with the August LSAT, we will just have reading comp and logical reasoning. But hey, even if games is your favorite section and you're going to take the test in June, if you don't get the best score you think you can get, that's okay. You just have to turn your love and focus to logical reasoning and reading comp even more than you have already and just keep going for that good score.
Yeah, we've been getting a lot of emails and questions from students asking, hey, I'm 10 points away, 5 points away from the score that I need to get a scholarship at the school I want to go to. But games is my best section. Do I take the test anyways? And I think my response has mostly been, if you know that the score you're going to get is not a score that you would apply with, then it's not time for you to take the LSAT.
That's right. You just got to turn your focus a little bit more to really logical reasoning, because that's the one thing that's changing, right? Games is going away and we're getting one more section of logical reasoning. So, yeah.
Although I would also tell people, I have also the belief that if you tell people to focus on reading comp instead of LR, then probably, you know, if they actually take your advice, then they might still do like a third of their time on reading comp. For whatever reason, people just are resistant to drilling RC, to doing RC time sections. So here's my advice. Focus on reading comp. And maybe that'll get you to a point where you're like at least spending some time in reading comp.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I can totally see that. People definitely spend more time on logical reasoning than reading comp. And I think it's kind of like the YouTube short phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right? It's so much easier to consume a short than it is to consume a show or a movie, God forbid. And reading comp is kind of like the difference in LR, right? LR, you just sit down, do one passage, one question, you're done, versus a longer passage and then 5 to 8 questions. It's really not that much, but it's more.
Yep.
And so people gravitate to logical reasoning. Yeah, good point. So focus on reading comp. And anyways, whatever you do there will help you in logical reasoning. You're the one who started those classes, right? The crossover classes?
Yeah, cross-training.
Training. Yeah.
Yeah, if you feel like you're strong in the logic games, but not so strong in RC, well, treat RC like a logic game. Or vice versa. I think those are probably going to end once the games go away, just because we would just be doing two versions of that class over and over again, just switching between the two sections instead of a cycle of six different ones. But
yeah. Still value though, right? For people who struggle with one section versus the other.
Yeah, I'll continue talking about it, just maybe not keep as it a as class. A whole class concept. Yeah.
Makes sense. Well, let's jump into this email from Lucy. Yeah. The subject is, how long is a score plateau?
Yeah, Lucy wrote in, said, how long or how many tests would you consider there being a score plateau? For example, in February, I got a 163 and 166 on my practice tests. And in early March, I finally got my first 170. This gave me a ton of hope that I'd continue to see an upward trajectory. However, throughout the rest of March and all of April, I proceeded to get a 160, 164, 165, 164 again, in that order. What's your advice on how to break out of this and into the high 160s once and for all? On my best test, well, she gives some score breakdowns. Looks like not quite perfect on LG. Maybe worst at RC, down to a minus 7. Lucy is registered for the June exam as their first official test. She says, thanks for all the help. I look forward to your response. Best, Lucy. So, yeah, what do you think? There's a natural fear from many people that when you start seeing the same scores over and over again, you ask, is this my plateau? Is this as good as it's going to get for me? What do you think?
In most cases, it's not. It's just a function of whether you're going to keep digging into the things that are giving you trouble. Here, Lucy says that she has the most resistance in reading comp, but even that's kind of a high level assessment. At the end of the day, if you get a question wrong in logical reasoning or in games or in reading comp, that's where you want to dig in, because that's where your problem area is. So figure that out. And then eventually that will mean a better score in that section, which of course will then mean a better score overall. But when you just focus on the whole score, I don't know, it can be really demoralizing, right? You're just looking at these big numbers and you're saying, okay, what big change do I need to make to go from 160 to 170 or even just 165 to 170? And really that score is the sum of a bunch of small choices through the section. Mm-hmm. Not the result of something big. I mean, on some level, I was thinking about this a little bit the other day. Like, you can give people advice. You could say to them, hey, stop giving the test so much respect. Think of every practice test or every official test as a practice test. These are broad pieces of advice that apply to the whole test. Mm-hmm. But where they really have their power is when you think about them question by question, right? It's when you're doing a question and you remember that and stop worrying about the time or stop worrying about how the test is different from whatever test you took before, that the power of that advice really comes into play. So even though it applies to the whole test, you're still really getting a benefit from it question by question. So I guess what I'm saying is I think everything comes down to, okay, what am I doing wrong in an individual question, and how can I do better on similar questions?
Yeah, 100%. I'm thinking about triathletes, which is essentially what you are when you take the LSAT, right? You're doing three different sections.
Yeah, you're a tri-academic, or is it?
Yeah, sure.
There's something like that? Okay, anyways, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, a tri-tester.
Yeah,
but triathletes, you know, you're swimming and then you're biking and then you're running, and you might be in an Ironman triathlon and think, oh, it took me 8 hours. How am I ever going to break out of the 8-hour plateau? Well,
sure.
How did you do on the swim that day? How did you do on the bicycle that day? How did you do running that day? How was your nutrition throughout all of those different phases? How are your transitions? Can you work on getting your bike clips on a little bit quicker? You know, transitioning out of your swim gear and onto the bike a little bit quicker. Lots of little micro things to focus on that will, like you said, build up to the larger improvement.
Totally. I'm even thinking as you talk about that, I'm not a triathlete, so I have no fucking clue, but someone could write in and tell us. But I imagine it might have even to do with every stroke. Like, are you pulling, you know, are you reaching too far? Are you not reaching far enough?
Sure.
Is your hand going down the center of your body as you stroke, or is it going off to the side? Because like, and then I imagine, like, I felt like, wasn't it that guy who got all those gold medals? What was his name again?
Michael Phelps.
Phelps. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He, right. Like at one point his goggles fell off, but he counted, he knew exactly how many strokes to the wall and then for the flip and then back and everything. So it didn't matter. He just reverted to counting. I mean, obviously you're concerned about every single stroke in that case. So
yeah, no, I think absolutely that makes sense. So I mean, just getting back to Lucy's question,
sure,
yeah, is this a score plateau? I would say no. That's very normal, and just from experience from the students we worked with, there are people who feel like they're in a score plateau for months or months longer than the 1 month or so that you've been in the 160s.
Yeah, totally. We only have four tests here.
yeah. And I've definitely know students who have seen those same scores or similar scores for longer periods of time and eventually have climbed out of it. So no, this is not the cap on your ability.
Yeah. Just keep digging in.
Yeah. What it might be over a longer period of time, if you don't see, or you don't feel like you're improving over a period of several months, that to you might be an indication that something's lacking in your approach or in how you study, maybe the consistency of your study or how it is that you're reviewing your mistakes. The scores over the long term maybe could be an indication that you need to tweak your approach.
Totally. Yeah. Like maybe you're not doing what we're talking about too, and that is digging into these questions enough. Right? You're still kind of, it's so common for people. I mean, Lucy, we'll let you off the hook here pretty soon and go on to the next email, but it's so common for people to finish the section, get seven wrong, and then go back and look at the question type for each of those seven questions. And say, I noticed that four of them were flaw questions. I must have a problem with flaw questions. It's like, yeah, well, there's also just a ton of flaw questions. So that could be why you see so many among the wrong answers that you got. And there are other flaw questions in the right answers. But what they're looking for is they're looking for like a trend so they can then just latch on to like one idea and then quickly catapult to a higher score, where ironically that catapult is going to come from what you do on the micro level, like how you read sentences and stuff like that.
No, that's a very important point, because I think just to belabor the triathlon metaphor, just to really grind it into the ground, when we talk about looking at your swimming form or how it is that you're, those micro adjustments, that's not, I think many people will hear that and think, oh, that means finding which question types I struggle on or finding what game types I struggle on. That's not what we're talking about. It's how well are you reading? How well are you understanding what you have read? Are you committed to dismissing wrong answers quickly? Those even smaller things that are more related to your skill as a reader and a thinker, and not those question type trends, which probably don't exist anyways.
Don't exist. Yeah. Or yeah. And even if they do, what are you going to do about it? Right. What, I mean, I guess you could do some of those question types, but at the end of the day, you got to dig into those questions and figure out what it is about the wording that's messing you up. Here's a common one: double negatives, right? People read a double negative in a flaw question answer choice and it trips them up, and they gloss over it. They get the question wrong. And then they're like, oh, okay, I'm not good at flaw questions. No, you're not good at understanding double negatives. And you're letting yourself skip those. And those are the very things that if you can unlock them, they will then help you with other questions down the road, regardless of whether it's a flaw question or not.
How do you deal with a double negative?
Sometimes I find myself translating it into a single positive.
Yes. Yeah. That would be my answer too. 100%.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I also do though, just like the reason I hesitate is because I do like being able to read things in multiple ways.
Yeah.
So for example, reading it, translating it into a single positive, being like, oh, okay, that's what you're saying. Yeah. And then going back to the double negative and seeing how that makes sense too. Right. So I'm not just letting that go so that both forms can be interpreted in the future.
Yeah. For instance, I will not avoid driving today.
Yeah.
I'll drive today.
Okay. Yeah. You will not avoid it. Okay. So it's definitely going to happen. Yeah. That's interesting. Same with fail, right? The LSAT does it with fail. Mm-hmm. Like they won't fail.
So they'll succeed.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Cool.
All right.
Yeah. The next one is from Anonymous. The subject is reapplying to schools that accepted you. I guess I'll go ahead and read this. I applied really late this cycle due to pressure from family. Okay. Super common. But I'm planning to retake the LSAT and apply again. That is great news. Good decision. Excellent. I got accepted into a school that was a reach for me with a 167, but I don't know if I want to pay the full price.
Don't.
I'm sorry to keep commenting here. I should just keep reading, but I would say that if you're hesitant about paying the full price, you're probably onto something and you shouldn't. So let's see what you have to say about that. I also have been accepted to many safety schools with money. If I reapply, how will schools that have already been accepted to view my application? Am I more likely to get rejected or waitlisted, especially for those that have given me considerable scholarships? I have been told by my family that I'm crazy for considering reapplying because I won't get into any better schools and all my safety and target schools won't accept me a second time, much less give me money. Hearing this has got me wondering if I'm really am crazy for considering reapplying. Any thoughts? For reference, I was scoring into the low to mid 170s when I took the LSAT the first time, but had a proctor interruption. So I hope I can do better on the LSAT. Thanks.
Very common question, common concern. Hey, I know that I did not get the best offers that I could have, but if I turn them down, will schools judge me for that? And if I try reapplying to the same schools next year, will they be like, oh, well, you turned us down last year, so why would we apply you? Why would we admit you this year? And we have all the evidence that they will, especially if you will reapply with a higher LSAT score, which you're going to. I mean, I know multiple Demon team members who applied, withdrew their applications, reapplied with a higher LSAT score, not only got into those same schools, but got better offers from those schools and better offers from higher ranked schools as well. Scholarship offers from schools that didn't let them in previous years. So yeah, the concern is understandable. It's just not backed up from what we have seen happening with our students.
Totally. Let's push this a little bit. So if Anonymous retakes the LSAT, and by the way, Anonymous, it sounds like you're planning to retake it once because you say, I plan to retake the test and apply again. I'd love for you to retake the test until you get scores that are consistent with your practice scores, right? Like,
yeah.
Don't make the mistake that you made last time and apply prematurely. So retake the test until you get scores in the low to mid 170s.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally on the higher end of your practice test range, and then apply. Just, it's like worlds are different, but let's assume for a second that Anonymous does that, takes the tests all five times, never breaks 167. Do you think Anonymous is still going to run into trouble?
No, I don't think so. I think schools will still want you. if they ask about your decision to withdraw and then reapply, I think you can, if they ask, don't like feel like you need to go explaining up front. You can always just respond, hey, I decided it wasn't the right time for me.
Totally. And that's it, right? And it's just like it's a non-issue.
Yeah. Plus, you're going to be applying at the beginning of the cycle instead of late in the cycle, which you did, and you acknowledged that was a mistake. But yeah, you're going to be applying in the beginning of the cycle. And I've heard from multiple students now who went ahead and applied late in this cycle, and the offers they got were nowhere near what they should have.
Yeah.
So you're going to do better if you apply early next cycle.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, if Anonymous takes the test again multiple times, never breaks 167. In fact, Anonymous's score goes down 165, 166, whatever. Your highest score on record is still going to be a 167. So that's what they're going to look at. And then you're going to apply early in the cycle. So it's almost certain that you're going to do the same or better.
Yep.
But the upside is huge, right? Like if Anonymous gets a 168, and that is like, seems unlikely given the scores from the low to mid 170s on their practice test. But even with a 168 and then applying early, Anonymous is now a totally different applicant.
Yep.
A totally better applicant. So unfortunately, your family just doesn't know how this game is played. That's all. So you have to, on some level, ignore them. This is great, by the way, because learning to listen to your family when they have good advice and learning to politely, kindly, lovingly say no thank you is power, right? Like we all have to learn to do that.
Yep.
And so here's an opportunity for you to do it earlier in your life. And it will work out for the best. And make sure you apply broadly.
For sure. Thanks, Anonymous. Best of luck.
Yeah.
Next one is from Alex, who asks about clerking. Alex writes in and says, hello, is there a tacitly acknowledged T cutoff point for judicial clerkship? T meaning, I guess, the rankings, right? We talk about the T14, T20. Mm-hmm. Is there a point at which you're not getting a clerkship? Also, is there a way to know how much of the class takes big law jobs? My interests in law school are primarily academic, but if I can't do it for the clerkship, I'm ready to work my ass off to make good money. I'm not interested in law school if it's going to result in a sub 100K job. Thanks, Alex. So if you go to abarequireddisclosures.org and click on the link for 509 required disclosures, you can select a year, for instance, 2023, select a school like University of California, Davis, which is close to me, hit generate report. And that's going to give you a PDF, which just gives you the basic info about the law school class of 2023, what the median LSAT and GPA were, how many people were what the acceptance rate was, also their scholarship information. This is the same data that is used to drive the LSAT Demon Scholarship Estimator. And you can find this same PDF, the 509 report, linked on the Scholarship Estimator. The other thing that you can get at abarequireddisclosures.org is a report on the school's employment outcomes, which they are also required to provide. So underneath the 509 required disclosures, you can click the button for employment outcomes. Do the same thing, pick a year, 2023, pick a school, UC Davis, generate the report, and then you'll get a PDF, which looks a little different, but it will have a breakdown of what the people from that graduating class or people in that year, where they ended up working, what their employment outcomes were. And it gives you full-time long-term, full-time short-term, part-time long-term, et cetera. And then it also tells you how many people ended up in law firms of different sizes. For instance, at UC Davis, out of how many people did they have? 178 total graduates. Mm. Those who worked in big law at a full-time long-term at a firm of 500 lawyers or more, 41 of the 178.
Yeah.
So that's all there. And you can also go down, they have federal clerkships, state, local, and territorial clerkships. So it looks like only two people at Davis got federal clerkships. Five of them got state or local clerkships. So you can get pretty granular. Assuming you trust these numbers that come from the law school, it'll tell you for any given class where people ended up working. So that's all really powerful to have. And I think would answer your question, does a school that I'm looking at tend to lead to the career outcomes that I'm interested in?
Yeah. So for at Davis, right, clerkships, only two people did federal clerkships and five people did state, local, or territorial clerkships. So not that many, but some.
Not that many, so, but some, yeah.
Yeah, what's the T cutoff? That's an interesting question. I don't know. You know, this is data we do want to incorporate into the estimator eventually, so that people can more easily see the employment outcomes as they're looking at different schools and scholarships.
Sure.
I'm wondering, let's take a guess. If we picked a school ranked like 10, what school 10, is ranked 10? Well,
I think Michigan is up around there. So let's see. Okay. If we go to University of Michigan employment outcomes report for 2023. And it looks like if we want to talk about clerkships, yeah, of 307 total graduates, 42 of them went into a federal clerkship. Mm. 18 went into a state or local clerkship.
Yeah.
So a higher percent. But even at that relatively high ranked school, it's, you know, less than a quarter that go into a clerkship. So that's another thing to consider is, these people who get these prestigious clerkships are probably going to be drawn from the top of the class, yeah. I would think. So if you're going to pay a bunch of money to squeak into a higher ranked school because they have higher clerkship placement numbers, will you be at the top of the class at that school?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, for here, 42 people out of 307 is around 14%. Now, some of the top of the class is also obviously going into big law. We don't know the percentage there, but just to play it safe, you got to be in the top 15%, maybe the top 20%. So that really goes back to, okay, well, if you can get a scholarship, full ride in particular, then you're much more likely to be in the top of the class. So now, is it a school where anyone gets clerkships? It's a balancing act, right? And that's what we really need to get into the estimator, because then we could kind of have an estimate, like, where are you likely to land? And then what are you likely to land in or out of that group that goes in? It's a tough estimate, but a rough estimate. It's probably better than nothing.
Yeah. Anyways, I don't think there is a hard cutoff for clerkships. But take a look at these employment outcome disclosures at abarequireddisclosures.org. Start looking at different schools. And I think that'll probably the best advice that we can give you at the moment.
Yeah, I wanted to see what you thought about this, Eric. So Alex says, my interests in law school are primarily academic.
Mm.
But then Alex concludes, I'm not interested in law school if it's going to result in a sub $100,000 a year job. I guess Alex is hoping to become
a professor, like a law professor, if they are doing it for the academics.
Yeah, I don't know that I understand this, because when I hear about that job, it sounds like big law, which doesn't sound academic. And clerkships, I don't know what they pay, but they're not necessarily like, I think they can lead to profitable jobs.
It's just
jobs.
Whatever, Alex is just telling me that whatever happens, they don't want to work in the public interest.
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, that's seems to be what I'm getting, which I don't know. Not going to comment on that.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. A lot of people go to law school to make money. Of course, they have to realize the chances of succeeding in that endeavor. But your goals sound a little bit conflicting, maybe. Anyways.
Yeah, maybe work out what it is that you really want out of a legal career before committing to law school. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, thank you. This next one is from Anonymous.
Yeah, Anonymous says, I'm scoring between 168 to 175, and I do not know how to break into the upper 170s. My LG and RC sections average between minus 0 to minus 2, but LR ranges between minus 2 to minus 8. I find myself getting frustrated during LR and overthinking answer choices. I was hoping to get some advice on how to improve for the June LSAT. Thanks so much. Any help would be appreciated. How do we combat our tendency to overthink answer choices? Or what does that even mean? Maybe let's start there. What does it mean to overthink an answer choice?
Yeah, I think it means different things to different people, but I do suspect that for a lot of people, overthinking is just they didn't do enough preparation before going into the answers. And so then they're debating between two answer choices that would otherwise not even that debate wouldn't even happen if they had done more preparation. So really become the boss of the passage. And by the boss of the passage, I mean someone who understands it inside and out. You're listening to that person make that argument and you understand exactly where they're coming from. And you also understand why they're confused. I mean, to understand why someone is confused or wrong or mistaken or making a logical flaw, you do need to understand their position clearly. You understand it clearly, and then you say, yeah, but. No, that's not always the case. Not all logical reasoning passages have arguments, and not all arguments are flawed, but the vast majority are, right? And so your ability to decide whether that argument or that passage is an argument and whether it's flawed and then why it's flawed or why it's not flawed is your then ability to predict an answer for that question. And if you do that, right, then that means you own the passage. You're the expert attorney. If anyone has any questions about that passage, you can answer them and tell them why they're right or wrong. And then when someone does ask a question, the test will ask you a question, right? Oh, which one of the following best describes the flaw in reasoning, or which one of the following most weakens the argument? You have an answer because you are the boss of that passage. I suspect that Anonymous is just not doing enough up front.
I think that's always what it comes back to is, were you an expert? Were you an expert in the subject matter of the passage? Because then, yeah, that will help you get rid of the wrong answers more quickly. And usually my response to people talking about overthinking is to say, well, you may have overthought a correct answer, but to pick the wrong one, you had to have underthought selecting the incorrect one. So overthinking, if it's going to lead to you getting a question wrong, overthinking always has to go hand in hand with underthinking in a different area. Mm-hmm. So watch out for that as well. And probably that comes from worrying about the time, right? You're debating answer choices and you're thinking about it and you have not yet fully grappled with the fact that, well, there's this answer choice I'm ready to pick. I don't love it. I kind of have an issue with it, but I've already spent 90 seconds on this question. So time for me to move on.
Totally. You know, when you said underthinking, it made me think about why people do pick wrong answers. And a lot of wrong answers are wrong because they depend on maybe one or often two, sometimes even three kind of iffy assumptions.
Yeah.
And the overthinking, or which turns out to be underthinking, but what the person is doing is they're like, well, I guess if you do this and you do that and you do this, then this would be helpful. And you're like, do you realize that the answer choice didn't say that those things are true? You're just assuming that if this is true and this is true, and then I combine that with this answer that I'm about to pick, that then this answer would work out and it would help the argument or hurt the argument or whatever you're trying to do. So I guess what's happening is that they're underthinking. They're not realizing that they're making assumptions that are somewhat iffy, and they're making more assumptions often than they would have to make for the correct answer. I'm not saying to never make assumptions. The correct answer often hinges on an assumption as well, but that assumption is less iffy.
Yeah.
And there are fewer of them.
Yes.
Than there is for the wrong answers.
Yeah. I recently with a student was talking about Occam's razor. You familiar with Occam's razor?
I've heard that like a million times. The thing that comes to my mind is like, what can go wrong will go wrong. Is that Occam's razor or is that something different?
No, that's Murphy's law.
Fuck. Okay. What's Occam's razor?
Occam's razor comes from, I think it was some old philosopher named Occam, and the really dumbed down version. It's essentially a heuristic. Yeah. It's a heuristic. It's a way of just like picking between two things. Or trying to, if you're trying to figure out what the explanation of a certain phenomenon is, like, how do we explain this thing that happened?
Mm-hmm.
The simpler answer is usually correct. That's kind of the dumbed down version. The real version of Occam's razor is the answer which requires the fewest or the smallest assumptions is usually correct. When picking between two possible explanations or two things, the one that requires the fewest assumptions is usually the correct one.
Usually. So this would get rid of a lot of conspiracy theories because they depend on, well, you're assuming this person had this motive to do this thing and they were in that place and they, for the last 20 years, they've been planning this, whatever they're planning. And they're like, yeah, but can't you see how it all worked together? And that was the big conspiracy. And it does happen, but it's far less likely to be the case. Okay.
Yeah. Or if you're trying to diagnose your cold, you know, like, well, not many assumptions would be required to diagnose that I just have a common cold versus some exotic illness, which would require me to have come in contact with someone who was recently overseas in an exotic place. And also, you know, so
yeah, medical diagnosis. My uncle came back from that faraway place and he stopped by and saw my sister for 2 minutes and then I saw her. So then like,
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have to make lots of assumptions, unlikely to be the correct explanation.
Yes. Yeah. So the next one is from Hannah. Subject is live versus only drilling.
Hello, Demon Team. I've been listening to your podcast for about 6 months and used many strategies to improve. Ignore the clock, focus on the passage first, etc. I started at 154 and have been practice testing in the high 160s. Games are my best section, so I signed up for June. I've gotten to 171, but am wanting to bring my average up before the test. Would you recommend live classes to help me ace the harder logical reasoning and reading comp questions? Or should I keep on doing what I'm doing, which is drilling without live classes? I know I'm capable of scoring in the 170s on an official test, and I want to be greedy. I think 1 month of live would be the best way for you to figure out whether it's going to help you or not. And if you, you know, benefit from it, you might continue on doing it. But if you don't, then yeah, I don't know. The best way to find out is to try it.
I guess my response would just be, are you still making progress? Doing what you're doing, do you feel like you're getting better every day? Because if so, maybe don't fix an approach that's already working.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it's worked on some level, right?
Yeah. I teach live classes. I think live classes are great for many students. I also didn't go to live classes myself, hardly ever, because I knew that for me, I just, having tried out some live classes, I figured out best use of my time is drilling on my own.
Hmm.
So I guess you do have to try it out to see.
Yeah, this is a little bit unusual because June is the last test with games, right? I don't know how tight money is, Hannah, but if you can afford live, I'd probably do it. I'd do it for May. I know it's self-serving to say that because obviously we get more when you pay for live than when you pay for basic or something like that. But you started at 154. You have 1 month left. You're someone who I would expect to get into 170s. You may not be able to do it by June, but definitely I want you to continue to be greedy and hope to get that eventually. If that's only with basic and drilling, totally fine. You know what? And even try live for a week. And if it's not working for you, just tell the help team and they'll give you a refund back to basic. So
yeah,
I don't think there's much risk.
No, I think it's worth trying. Just don't let live classes completely replace
the
work that you're doing on your own.
100%. Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Thanks, Hannah. Next one's from Anonymous, who's asking about a GPA addendum. Would it be worth it to write a GPA addendum that explains lower grades in one specific semester? In particular, I had a semester where a very close friend of mine was dying of cancer, and the responsibility of managing his donation campaign finances combined with the immense emotional weight of the situation did affect my academic performance that semester. Would it be worth writing about this? So GPA addendum to address bad grades in one semester.
Yeah, I think you could. I think you could pull it off. I don't think I would talk about the donation campaign. Instead, I would just say, in the fall of 2022 or whenever this happened, a very close friend of mine was dying of cancer and my grades suffered as a result. My overall GPA without this semester is X. And then that's it. I think if you get into like, oh, donations and emotional weight, people understand. A very close friend was dying of cancer. Let them infer that it was emotionally taxing, and then give them the number to anchor on. But that's it. It's like two sentences, maybe three.
Totally agree.
The next one is from Anonymous as well. The subject is academic suspension. The background here is that 10 and a half years ago, Anonymous withdrew from undergrad. They later completed their degree at a different institution. You want to read it?
Sure. Last week, I sent myself an official transcript to see what LSAC will see. To my surprise, at the end of the transcript, it says academic suspension. I looked at a 10-year-old transcript dated the month after my withdrawal from the college. There is no mention of a suspension, only a withdrawal. I have tried various methods to get the school to change this, but to no avail. I don't understand how you can suspend someone who was no longer a student. That does seem odd. Since the poor grades from my first college will be part of my LSAC report anyways, does having academic suspension on my transcript make things any worse? I want to know if it's worth continuing to fight this school. Thanks for everything you guys do. Yeah, that's interesting. So withdrew from the school, and then the initial transcript you got was showed that, yeah, you withdrew from school. But then an updated transcript years later says that, no, actually, you were suspended back then.
I wonder what. So first of all, academic suspension doesn't sound good. That sounds like you messed up academically and then you got suspended for it, which is a negative thing, right? It's not like a neutral withdrawal. I wonder if what happened here is that Anonymous withdrew but didn't follow the right procedures, maybe with just stopped going to class. I mean, that would be pretty crazy, but if you didn't do it exactly right, it's possible that you could have had some really poor grades in that last semester, and then that puts you on probation and then suspension because you just never even interacted with the school again. Either way, I would try to figure out exactly what happened and try to get that removed.
Yeah. Yeah, Anonymous says that they have tried various methods to get the school to change this, but to no avail. We don't know what you've tried. I would continue to be a thorn in their side about it. Sometimes persistence is really what it takes. Sometimes they will keep telling you no only as many times as they can until they finally say yes. But this seems like something that I would want to continue to work on. That academic suspension on the transcripts doesn't look good.
I would maybe, I don't know if Anonymous has done this, but maybe try to first totally understand why they gave it to you and why they didn't are unwilling to remove it. Because maybe there's some fact in there that they are misunderstanding. And to get that fact, you have to understand what their position is. Yeah.
Yeah, that could be a good way to frame your follow-ups, right? Just, hey, I'm just trying to understand what this means and where this came from.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Best of luck. Yeah, follow up. Let us know what happens.
Yeah.
Next one. Yeah, this is a kind of interesting one that came in from a listener, Laura, who noticed LSAT Demon mentioned in the post-LSAT survey. Laura says, I just took the post-LSAT survey for the third time, and this is the first time I've seen LSAT Demon listed as one of the selections for what study platform I use to prepare. In the past, I've had to select other and fill it in. Well, thank you for doing that, Laura.
Yeah.
Just wanted to let you guys know. Thought it was cool. Yeah. Do you ever do these types of surveys, Ben? Because I'm pretty sure I don't do these types of surveys. Just hit
no.
Ignore.
Yeah. Just keep like, no, not today. Right. No, I don't. But I wonder how many people do these. I mean, maybe they, you know, you're checking through and you just want to make sure you don't miss anything for your official test.
Yeah.
Yeah, the question says, which LSAT prep materials and or services did you use to prepare for the most recent LSAT? Please choose all that apply. And they list LawHub, the free version. They list LawHub, the paid version. They list Khan Academy. They list all the books of 10, which you can find on Amazon. Although I would imagine they're kind of going away since everything is online. But then they also list a couple companies here. And then LSAT Demon, lowercase d, we'll have to get that fixed. But I think what's striking here is that Kaplan isn't listed. Princeton Review isn't listed. Back in the day, it was always like Testmasters, Blueprint. These companies were big competitors.
Yeah.
Not mentioned. And we don't really hear about them much on the podcast either from listeners. So I don't know. Maybe they've turned their focus to other tests and just lost interest in the LSAT. Who knows?
I don't know if there's anything really else to say other than yeah. Thanks for filling out that survey, Laura, and thanks yeah. for letting us know.
Yeah, thank you. Cool. Word of the week. So you suggested this first word, ascribe.
Yeah, it was a word that came up in class last night on a reading comp question. And the question was something like, the author ascribes which one of the following views to the economists mentioned in the passage. And a few students weren't sure what the word ascribe meant. And it's one I think you'll run into fairly frequently. So good to know. Just means attributes. The author attributes which one of the following views to the economists.
Yeah. Yeah, that's perfect. The word that I encountered this week, which I've definitely seen before, but just reminded of it, is miserly. And miserly describes a person who is extremely stingy with their money and resources, often going to great lengths to avoid spending money, even to the point of foregoing basic comforts or necessities. Yeah, this term is generally negative. You could think of like Scrooge as a miserly person. Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes into my head is Scrooge in his large empty home eating cold gruel despite all of his money.
Yeah. So try not to be overly miserly, or try not to be miserly at all. It sounds like it's just pure negative, extremely stingy. Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show and subbing for Nathan. I have no idea what he's doing, but he's traveling somewhere. Do you know?
I don't. Probably playing golf somewhere. Who knows?
He's playing. He's just sitting back, just listening to us. He's like, hey, I don't want to do the episode this week. But yeah, thanks for coming on. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can always email help@lsatdemon.com, and you can check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. If you listen to this podcast on Spotify or wherever, maybe even YouTube, please subscribe, follow us, do whatever you can. It really helps other people find the show and get this information for free. And there's a lot we want to share. I was just talking to someone the other day, and I said, there's so much I want to tell you about scholarships and how to go to school for free. They hear that and they think it's kind of like fake, right? They feel like it's clickbait or something, like go to school for free. What the fuck are you talking about? But I was like, well, just listen to the podcast. Just start hearing what people are doing to basically get their score up and then apply smartly, right? And at the right time and so on. I mean, it's not easy to go to law school for free, but it's not some mystical, you know, clickbait where in reality, once you dig into it, you can't do it. No, you can do it. And in fact, if you're not going for free or, you know, close to free, you probably did something wrong. Probably in most cases.
Yeah.
And that's sad.
Yeah.
So anyways, subscribe, follow us if you're so inclined. That would be very helpful.
Leave a review too.
Oh yeah. Leave a review. That'd be great. That was episode 453 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing ya. Don't pay for law school.